It's the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper with a question. Who should you trust when it comes to buying a cookbook or cooking from a blog? Because a lousy recipe, badly written, or worse yet, untested, can make you feel like a failure. And never mind the money and the time you wasted, or the embarrassment. It might even convince you that you can't cook at all. But recipes can be scoped out if you know what to look for and who to trust. So stick around for How to Pick a Recipe, Who Really Writes Those Chef's Cookbooks, and Japan's Unique Way with Spring Veggies. This hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. There is one kind of food writer who gets stuffed in the closet when cookbook awards are given out. He or she is the ghost, the person who does the actual writing for that busy chef or celebrity. Sounds like a dream job, right? Well, maybe. I've got one of the busiest ghosts in the business with me. J.J. Good has been in the trenches ghosting 5 chef's books and has 2 more coming out soon. J.J., good to have you with us.
Thanks. I'm so excited to be here.
So your first gig was writing a book with Iron Chef Morimoto. Now, what was that like?
Just the usual first gig. Went straight to the top, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. You didn't fool around.
But it was an accident, of course, because, you know, why would they hire a 25-year-old to write this book? They had hired a real writer, a really fancy writer,
I think. Writer.
And he fell through, and I'm not sure why. And they were desperate, and they asked my more successful friends. And no one could do it because they only had 3 weeks to do this enormous project, something like 50,000 words, something like that.
Three weeks?
3 weeks. Yeah, it was terrifying. But of course, I had to do it. You don't get a chance like that and turn it down. But since the project was rushed, I only had the chance to interview Morimoto 2 times in person. And his English is fine, but he's more comfortable speaking in Japanese. And his assistant, who was acting as his translator, was supposed to translate. And her English was not so great either. So he would give me these, what sounded like really promising 15-minute meditations on rice or fish. And she would translate them and unfortunately boil them down to 1 or 2 sentences.
How did you handle this? What did you do?
Basically, he was a very funny guy. So when he did say something in English, and I thought it was funny, I would sort of use that line or two or phrase as a starting point to get his voice in there, and then sort of spin a yarn, a factual yarn. I would sit up all night with piles and piles of books. I do like Japanese food a lot, so I have all these books at home, and I just pored over them.
The book is brilliant. The book is really very well done.
I can't take credit for the parts that are well done. Quentin Bacon, who's a famous food photographer, did these beautiful, beautiful food photos, and I think maybe people just look at the photos and ignore the rest. I'm hoping. My dad noticed. Of course, I was so excited when this thing came out. It's so beautiful, and he immediately opened it up and found that salmon roe somewhere in the book was spelled R-O-W. Leave it to your dad to do that.
But you've done other books with other chefs, and the key to this business of writing chef's books seems to be getting into the mind of a chef.
Yes.
How do you do that?
Well, the way you don't do it is what I did in the beginning, which was try to sit them down at a table and talk to them. These are people who haven't sat down in a chair since, you know, the early 90s. They are up on their feet all the time. They're cooking. They're dealing with disasters left and right. Cooks are arrested and oven doors are blown off and stoves are on fire, and they can't. They don't want to sit down. It feels unnatural. So what I found is the best way to get them to talk, to open up when they're at their most comfortable and when they're most happy, is when they're at the stove cooking. And when that's when the stories sort of bubble up. I work with a wonderful guy named Roberto Santibanez, and when he's making a tamale, all of a sudden you're hearing about the tamale he made with his mom, the tamale his grandmother used to make from fresh sweet corn. So it really gets them thinking, it gets them happy, it gets them comfortable, it gets them talking.
And this is where you get the meat of the books.
Yes.
These are the moments.
Yes. And the process is funny. It's sort of, I mean, I spent a year, at almost a year with these chefs on and off, talking and cooking and taking notes. And then it's sort of, you distill all that information, the best bits, the best stories, and those become the head notes, those become the introductions, those become the stories that I think really make a book great.
What are the trickiest parts for you?
The trickiest part is probably convincing the chefs that they need to measure. There's nothing they hate more than measuring things. They refuse to stick thermometers in things. They hate stuffing herbs, fresh delicate leaves of basil inside of a cup measure. So I push them in the direction of measuring. They push back, and usually the result is just right.
So you're actually developing the recipes with them?
Sometimes, yeah. I'm ideally I will watch them cook and sort of take dictation. They say, you know, I'm going to add basil. And I say, can we measure how much basil you're going to add? And they say, no, why would you measure basil? And I say, well, because they have to know how much basil to use. And isn't it obvious when the chicken is done cooking? And I say, well, not for dummies like me. And those are the people who are going to be reading and trying to follow the recipes in your book. They have a good sense of humor about it, usually.
Yeah. So, JJ, why write books this way? I mean, do you ever yearn to say what you want to say the way you want to say it?
I used to. I started out writing articles more or less in my own voice. And when I got the chance to work with these chefs, I realized I liked it so much more. I mean, I'm basically a kid. I grew up in New Jersey. I didn't go on a plane till I was 19. I've been out of the country a handful of times. So whose opinion would you rather hear? Would you rather hear my opinion, or would you rather hear the opinion of these chefs who have been doing this for decades, who have been studying food and culture of Thailand or Mexico or working in kitchens for their entire lives? I mean, I think they have so much more to say than I do.
I think you're too modest. But
JJ,
really interesting work. Thanks for telling us about it.
Thanks so much for having me.
J.J. Good writes about food under his own byline and writes for many chefs. His latest collaboration is with Chef April Bloomfield and her book, The Girl and the Pig. Have you ever suffered recipe betrayal? The recipe sounds great, so you buy the ingredients, you follow the directions to the letter, and you get something your dog wouldn't eat? This is when you decide that you can't cook at all. But trust me, this is not you. Most likely, it's the writer who doesn't test the recipe or wrote it badly. Really short recipes, by the way, are the biggest betrayers. But there are key things to look for in a recipe before you head to the store. Here's what you want to look for. Does the recipe tell you these things? What you can do ahead? How to store and for how long? Are the ingredients specific? For instance, not 1 pound of beef, but 1 pound of well-marbled beef chuck. Do the instructions tell you exactly what kind of pot and utensils to use, the level of heat, timing, what the food should look like, sound like, smell like, and how to tell if it's done? Pick recipes with all of these, and you might find that you were meant to cook. Well, check out the website for our good recipe, bad recipe checklist and a list of some of the food world's most reliable writers and sites. It's all there, splendidtable.org. In New Orleans recently with Jane and Michael Stern for their annual RoadFood.com bash. It was an intimate gathering, 65,000 folks who came together to meet, greet, and eat from all the great food stands that the Stearns had brought together. But as we were leaving, the Stearns were talking about one place they had to get to, this place called Morning Call. Jane, Michael, so did you guys get to the place?
We did, and I am so glad we did, because Morning Call serves what we really think are the best beignets in New Orleans, hence the best beignets anywhere.
Explain beignet.
Okay, a beignet is a holeless French donut, a fritter. And beignets always come with powdered sugar. And so they're big shakers of powdered sugar on the table. You get your beignets, I mean, literally moments out of the fry kettle, and you sprinkle on the powdered sugar. The only problem that we have is it's very hard to sprinkle on enough powdered sugar because you want these things totally blanketed with the stuff. Actually, the guy who runs Morning Call told us what they used to do was have big bowls full of powdered sugar, and you could take your beignet and just run it through there. The health department frowned on this for fear of people double dipping. So now you have to sprinkle it on.
So what's Morning Call like?
Oh, my God, it's so wonderfully vintage. It's like stepping into the 1930s.
Well, actually, from the outside, it looks kind of like any place in a strip mall. But you have to realize that originally, Morning Call was one of the coffee places in the French Market. And when they moved out of the French Market in the 1970s, they went into a place that looks normal from the outside, but they brought all their fixtures with them. So you walk in, and there's this mirrors all along the wall, these beautiful incandescent lights. And best of all, they brought the things that they make café au lait with from the French Market. And, you know, café au lait literally means coffee with milk. And
right,
a lot of
right.
places, that's what it is, just coffee with a lot of milk in it. At Morning Call, to watch them make the café au lait is a thing of beauty because there are these two huge silver pitchers. The woman starts pouring the coffee into a cup, and then when it's about maybe two-thirds full, she picks up the other silver pitcher and starts pouring the milk in such a way that they swirl together and create a big foamy top. It's just gorgeous.
And it's chicory coffee. It's that very, very, very strong New Orleans coffee. If I'm not mistaken, I think Morning Call started at the French Market in 1870. I mean, this has been around a long time.
And it's very old New Orleans in the sense that the waiters and waitresses wear these kind of white uniforms with black bow ties. You know, but it's utterly informal. I mean, three beignets and a café au lait will cost you less than $5.
Oh, my. Now, the place that's famous for the coffee and the beignet is the Café du Monde, which is
yes.
in the French Market. Does this predate that? I mean, is this really sort of more the real thing than the Café du Monde?
I think they're both from the 19th century. Which predates the other, I'm not certain. And the way it used to be was that Café du Monde was at one end of the French Market and Morning Call was at the other. But when urban renewal started, Morning Call had to go, and they moved out to Metairie, which is just outside the city.
Uh-huh.
I think I kind of like Morning. Well, I love them both, but there are more locals at Morning Call. It doesn't quite seem as touristy because
it's out of the way.
Yeah, it's out of the way. And I do have to just add something very funny. Michael and I and our friend Stephen, who is with us, all of us were wearing all black.
A big mistake.
We went in there. We were covered in powder sugar.
As was our table and the floor around the table.
Right. It's so much fun eating out with you two. Your manners are just exemplary. Thanks,
guys.
Bye, Lynn.
The Stearns are the minds and the appetites behind roadfood.com. Find information on their picks at splendidtable.org. We're going to be back with a new technique for spring vegetables from Japan and wine finds from Greece. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You want to make the most of your spring vegetables? Have them stand proud in all their natural wonder. We'll try some Japanese techniques. This is the cuisine of meticulous attention to flavor and freshness and of specific techniques to tease them out. It's also the country and cuisine that Haris Salat fell in love with, and he's been studying it for years. Haris co-authors Japanese cookbooks, and has the JapaneseFoodReport.com. Harris, welcome.
Thank you so much, Lynn, for having me.
There's a dish on your site that practically screams spring, and it uses this technique, and I'm probably not going to pronounce it correctly, called ohitashi?
Ohitashi, yes. Ohitashi is incredibly simple, but incredibly deep. You can find a lot of this in Japanese cuisine. It is a way of infusing umami and flavor into vegetables, but without overwhelming those vegetables. This process helps the vegetables, the intrinsic flavor of the vegetables, really come out. It's quite amazing.
Now, what you've got on the side is a bowl of pea pods and mushrooms and asparagus in this little pool of broth. So I guess the best thing is, can you walk us through how it's done?
Sure. Let's take a step back and just talk about dashi for a quick second. Dashi means stock in Japanese cooking, but it's more than stock. It's really the foundation of the cuisine. And when you say dashi, you're talking classically. There are many different dashi, but when people just say dashi, there is a dashi that's made from kombu, which is a type of kelp, and katsuobushi, which is skipjack tuna that has undergone this really remarkable process of natural preservation. And the kombu has also been dried. And then when the two of them come together in dashi, they create this amazing savoriness and this really incredible flavor. And that's underlying the cuisine and underlying ohitashi.
Now, I know you can make it from scratch, but there are packets of instant dashi that I see in stores. Are those any good?
Those packets are fantastic.
Really?
There's been this really kind of evolution of dashi packs and dashi powders that are all natural. In the past, powdered dashi was spiked with a lot of MSG and tasted really fake. But now producers have figured out how to create really all-natural dashi by freeze-drying the ingredients. And, yeah, you could use this to make dashi instantly.
This is great. Okay, now back to the dish.
Okay. Ohitashi, it could be extremely simple or extremely complex. I've had the good fortune of training in restaurants in Japan over the past few years. And in some restaurants, they had over a dozen different ohitashi combinations to match the flavor of each particular vegetable that they were doing this process to, okay? And if you're at home, you have to do exactly that. No, kidding. If you're at home, you can do something much simpler, what people at home in Japan do. So the most basic thing is to take 1 cup of dashi and 1.5 tablespoons of usukuchi soy sauce. And I'll explain that in a second.
Okay.
You take these two ingredients, you put them in a pot, bring them to a boil, turn it off, cool in an ice bath, and then you're ready to use the dashi for steeping. But let me get back to usukuchi. There are a lot of regional cooking traditions in Japan that we're not super aware of in the United States, but the two big ones are Tokyo-based and Osaka and Kyoto-based, which are two different regions, Kanto and Kansai, in Japan. Mm-hmm. And usukuchi is really the soy sauce of the Osaka-Kyoto region, and it differs from the kind of Japanese soy sauce that you normally see in that it's lighter in color and saltier and has less body. And so it doesn't infuse as much of an overpowering soy sauce flavor into this dish and also doesn't overpower the natural color of the ingredients that you're going to steep in this ohitashi broth. In any case, it's a great product, and you can find it at any Japanese market or even Asian markets in general.
So if we, for some reason, can't get that soy sauce, could we possibly water down? Would that be a sin?
You know what? If you can't get that soy sauce, just use regular Japanese soy sauce.
It's not going to be a big deal.
I mean, Kikkoman is brewed in California. It's a great product. It's widely available. That's fine, too. What I like about Japanese cooking is that the gap between, let's say, the finest expression of the cuisine and what we cook at home is not that wide. It's really a question of intent. So, yeah, if you can get your hands on usukuchi, it's great. If you can't, that's great, too, and it'll still be delicious. Now, once you have created this ohitashi broth and you've cooled it in the ice bath, you have to prepare the ingredients that you're going to steep in this liquid. And in Japanese cooking, you really want to get a sense of the texture of an ingredient, the color, the seasonality. As you mentioned in the beginning, there's a word called shun, which is the expression of the very, like, perfect seasonal time for something. And it's usually, you know, could be a few days or a few, you know, a week or of a certain ingredient is in shun. So when you can find beautiful spring ingredients, new potatoes, we were talking about mushrooms, asparagus, okra when it comes up is great, even cherry tomatoes, spinach, wax beans, so many different vegetables. And what you want to do is blanch and shock them. So you want to just cook them just enough so they start to break down a little bit and then stop the cooking process. So you put them in boiling water with no salt. Wait, 30 seconds or where you get a sense that the colors come out of the vegetable and it's just started to cook a little bit. Then you transfer it to an ice bath to stop the cooking. And that's all you need to do. And then you put it into the ohitashi broth for, let's say, 6 hours or overnight.
And that's,
and you're ready.
That's it.
Yeah.
Sounds so perfect for right now. Harris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Harris Salat is the creator of JapaneseFoodReport.com. Try out the ohitashi technique with his recipe for spring vegetables steeped in dashi. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Since most of the news coming from Greece these days is about economic turmoil, we thought it time to look for a bright spot. And there is one, Greek wine. You know, in the days of Socrates, pouring a Greek wine for your pals was like today flaunting a magnum of cult Cabernet. And then the reputation of Greek wines nosedived for a very long time. But today, something new is afoot. Tara Q. Thomas is tracking it. She's senior editor of Wine and Spirits magazine and author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Wine Basics. Tara, welcome.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
So, Tara, what is happening with Greek wines? You used to go to restaurants and you'd drink the retsina, that's the white wine with the pine resin in it, and some okay wines. But now they're absolute stunners. What's changed?
What's changed is that Greece joined the EU in the 1980s, and the winemakers had to work really hard and really fast to catch up. They had lost a lot of time in the decades before that, but they had fabulous materials to work with, grapes that you don't find anyplace else in the world, and an incredible variety of different wine-growing regions. And they've really made a lot of success in a really short period of time.
How are wine pros reacting to this? I mean, are they kind of turning up their noses, or are they enthusiastic?
They used to. I'll tell you that the very first time I set up a Greek wine tasting at Wine and Spirits, it was 1997, and I scrounged all over for Greek wines. I came up with maybe 40 of them, and then I had to get down on my hands and knees and beg people to come taste with me. Now, I have people lining up, because Greece is a sommelier's dream. They're really high-quality wines made from little-known grapes and entirely unique grapes, and they're also made with food in mind. So it's something that the sommeliers can offer their customers that, you know, no other country offers, and they tend to be really great value as well.
Okay, but this is a tough thing for consumers. You know, you go into a wine shop, and if you do find Greek wines, we know nothing about them. The names are confusing. We don't know what to look for. So how would you begin?
I think I would begin in the most obvious place, and that would be Santorini. If there's one iconic Greek wine, it would be Santorini. It's also very easy because Santorini wines are made from a grape called Assyrtiko, but you don't have to pronounce the grape. They're labeled Santorini. Easy to remember. But also, these are white wines, and they're as dramatic as that sun-bleached, craggy rock that we call Santorini. It's actually the remnants of a volcano. There's almost no soil that these vines grow in. They're just blasted by the sun and the sea. And they taste like the sun and stone and sea. They're beautiful. They're crisp. They're lemony. They have this mouthwatering salinity. They're gorgeous. But also, I would say, they're no easy quaffers. These are wines that are built with food in mind. In fact, Greek winemakers on Santorini really like to have their white wines with lamb.
Huh.
They have the, they have the structure. They have the acidity. But you can have them with anything, with a nice fish pulled directly from the sea, with a little bowl of olive oil and feta and some bread to soak it up. But you need to have some food on the side. That's one key thing, I think, with all Greek wines.
What's the pricing like on Greek wines?
It depends on where you are. But for the most part, you're looking at wines between $12 and $25. You could find some that are higher than that. But for a really great Santorini, let's say the Boutari, which is pretty widely found, I think it's running about $17 right now. Some other names to look for would be Sigalis and Yea, and theirs might be a little bit higher, but still, you know, no more than 25.
What about a red?
Well, for red wine, I would go to Nemea. Again, the wine is labeled by the region, Nemea. It's easy to remember. You don't have to deal with the grape. And it's a region of the Peloponnese, about 2 hours south of Athens. And to me, I often think of it, no offense to Merlot producers out there, but as Merlot with personality. It's got that lovely, round, plump, cherry-like fruit, but it also has these sort of foresty, herbal qualities to it. It's got shape. It's got lusty fruit, but it's not just a big fruit bomb either. Mm-hmm. And there's some wonderful ones out there from producers like Skouras, Yea, Driopi. Again, these are running about $20. $15 to $20.
Going back to that Retsina, the famous Greek wine with the pine resin in it, mm-hmm. Do you have any idea where that originally came from?
It was actually a pan-Mediterranean thing in ancient times. The ancients used pine resin to seal the clay amphorae that they kept the wines in. And, of course, the pine resin did flavor the wines that were kept in these big containers, and they came to like that flavor. For some reason, the Greeks are the only ones who held on to the tradition. And, you know, I have to say, many Greek winemakers don't like to hear me say this, but a good Retsina can be a really wonderful thing. If you can imagine a very, very hot day, and you're sitting at a table with your feet in the sand, and you have a table laid out with a little fried fish and some garlicky tzatziki, and some salty feta, and, you know, all these little plates with these really strong flavors, that Retsina tastes really refreshing.
Mm-hmm. So, Tara, with the Greek economy, what's happening with the winemakers?
It's a really tough time for the winemakers right now, especially those that don't export, that don't produce enough wine to export, aren't big enough producers. As you can imagine, a lot of Greeks are not buying wine for personal consumption. So So that leaves a lot of pressure on us here, I think, in the States to support the Greek market by buying their wines.
I don't think that's going to be any kind of sacrifice for us.
Me neither.
Tara, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tara Q. Thomas is senior editor of Wine and Spirits magazine. Now for her Greek wine suggestions and a match for those wines, the recipe for grilled shoulder lamb chops Greek style, check out the website, splendidtable.org. I love diets. They're so entertaining, especially the weird ones. And then there are the ones that take people down an entirely different path. Like, for instance, the ROYGBIV diet. This was the diet that tempted Amanda Thiroff and her pal Sean.
Sean and I don't begin the ROYGBIV diet with any specific intention in mind. I even hesitate to call it a diet, because I think the word implies weight loss or some kind of interest in nutrition. This diet, in which we will spend a week consuming only one color of food each day, this is not a diet at all. This is art. 1 week, 7 days, one day for each color of the rainbow. Our first day would be red, our second, orange, then yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet, ROYGBIV. Like any diet, ours would be limiting, but instead of cutting carbs or gluten, we'd cut color. Not this week would we feast on the diversity of hues found in most meals, the reds with the greens, the delicious rainbow. No, this week would be all about austerity, the monochrome. We're not sure what we hope to discover, if we hope to discover anything at all.
I'm slicing up some red peppers, because today's red day.
Sean and I are in my kitchen in Brooklyn. It's a Thursday afternoon. Red lunch.
Right now I'm making a salad with peppers, pear, radish, and pomegranate, which is You know, I'm no chef. That's kind of a dicey combination. I don't know how it's going to taste.
I heat up a can of Campbell's tomato soup, and we go over some ground rules. First and foremost, to the best of our ability, we'll eat only naturally colored foods. Red peppers, in. Spicy Cheetos, out. Beverages, alcohol included, are not to be exempted from the color challenge.
I have a box of white wine at home. I guess I can only drink that on yellow day.
The only liquids that are exempt are water, clear, and coffee, black. Two things that we decide are necessary to sustain life. We will make no other exceptions.
All right, let's put this in some bowls.
Yeah.
Bowls and plates.
Soup and salad.
Mmm!
Is it weird?
That's good. It actually tastes red.
Well, it should.
It's got a red flavor to it.
You'll never, ever have a salad that's more red.
Orange Day is like a feast. It's like Thanksgiving Redux. We make mountains of squash and yams. We make Kraft macaroni and cheese, which is ostensibly both yellow and non-natural. Really, is there anything less natural than that packet of powdered cheese? This is, perhaps, the first fissure in our diet's solid bedrock. This is the fourth banana I've had today. On yellow day, I don't have time to cook before work. I pack myself potato bread and mustard sandwiches and cut the crust off. Sean and I text each other photos of all of our meals. His photos are usually of some kind of dried fruit. Mine are usually of potato chips or candy. Today, he sends a photo of dried pineapple rings, like tiny golden buoys. Green day. Sweet green day. I eat kale, I eat broccoli, I eat Brussels sprouts and arugula. I swear I can feel these foods reviving me, lifting me from the depths of banana and cheese despair. Welcome to paradise. But no holiday lasts forever.
So what do we have here, Sean?
Blueberries. And tons of blue chips.
Did you ever stop and consider the fact that there are almost no naturally blue foods? Even blueberries aren't really that blue. They're kind of purple.
Why are there no blue foods in nature?
I don't know. I mean, think about the things in nature that are blue. Fungus. Poison.
That's it.
What else? There's not much.
Sean and I text each other photos of blueberries. Dried blueberries, ripe blueberries, blueberry fruit leather. I begin to wonder if we're just not trying hard enough. On my last day, Violet Day, I decide I'm going to get creative. I buy an enormous red cabbage and an eggplant, and I roast the eggplant with a bulb of garlic. Baba ganoush! I blend it in my roommate's Cuisinart. Because it looks brownish, I cut up some cabbage, toss it in, hit the pulse button. It turns a sickening shade of violet. It looks like flowers in a meadow. It looks like lavender soap. It does not look like food. Sean texts me a photo of two different kinds of yogurt. Purplish slop, he writes. We've become disillusioned. At 8 p.m., a mere 4 hours from the project's completion, Sean texts me that his faith was gone, that he'd eaten a bowl of multicolored chili. Stay strong in my wake, he writes.
Tell me about your fall from grace.
I don't want to speak about that. I was upset. I wasn't necessarily upset about it because I felt so much better immediately afterwards. And I guess maybe that was something of a lesson. This is not a healthy experiment. It wasn't a healthy week.
No, it wasn't. But that was never the intention, was it? I do make it to midnight, at which point I eat a chocolate truffle, brown. Then another one. The next morning, I wake up early to make pizza dough. On my pizza will be every color of the rainbow. Red sauce, orange pepper, yellow pepper, arugula, eggplant. No blueberries, though. I hope not to see another blueberry for a long, long time.
Amanda Thieroff is an independent radio producer and media educator in Brooklyn, New York. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what can be revealed by the size bites we take of our food? Well, we're going to be back with the answer to that and your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or call us, 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what can be revealed by the size bites we take of our food? Well, apparently, if we take small bites, the food has intense aromas and flavors. We unconsciously want less of it. So at least that's the science from a research project in the Netherlands. There, researchers gave people a custard-like dessert, but they held different scents under their noses as they ate. Such an attractive thought. Sure enough, strong scents led to smaller bites and eating less. So now they're pondering if scent is the new portion control for dieters. Of course, they discounted those of us who take small bites to make the pleasure last longer.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me.
It is time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, call us, 800-537-5252. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Let's see, who are we going to talk to first? We have Luella calling from Rome, Georgia. Luella, hi, what's up?
I'm so relieved to have your help on this, Lynn.
You sound like a woman in trouble.
Well, you know, semi sort of. I have a big event coming up. Our daughter's getting married, and I'm going to do a very small luncheon to 7 people immediately following the ceremony. So the two things I've run into in coming up with a menu that have really stymied me, I've got prep issues. I'm just going to have maybe an hour or two before that we leave for the wedding, and then maybe a little time the night before. But the other thing is the groom and his family are French, and we live in Georgia. So I want to do something that is, you know, a nod to the South and the bod and all that. But I have a feeling if I trot out my fried chicken and biscuits and gravy that, you know, it's just not going to be exactly what...
Why not?
Well, I think it's a little heavier than what they're used to, and they're traveling just in and out for a long weekend, so I can't imagine getting back on that plane for 12 hours. You know, pecan pie, potato salad, biscuits, gravy, you know, green beans and ham. So what do I do here? I really want it to be authentic, but I also want to, you know,
well, let's think
keep
about
it light.
Let's think about some of the other dishes that you do, that you love to do, and that are very much the tradition of your family.
Right, right.
Because this is really a time to stay with things that are family favorites. It's
right.
Such a wonderful moment, and it's such a moment to celebrate your own traditions and welcome them into your family's life with
right.
those traditions. And I'm also thinking what would be easy. And, you know, ham may not be light, but ham and biscuits with a great salad. And I don't know, are you into congealed salads or do you prefer green salads or both?
Well, you know, I like them both. I think probably the family would prefer a green salad. You know, there's nothing like a good tomato aspic or some homemade mayonnaise.
But I don't think that's a shabby thing either. I would have both of them. I would have both of them. And do you do ham and biscuits? Because what I like about that is that you could do tiny biscuits, have the ham pre-sliced, where you can just slip the biscuits. You know, if you want to warm them, you can have them ready to just be slipped in the oven and maybe do that as a first course and then have the salads and have something very light as that main dish. And now, You know, Luella, I'm just thinking of your fried chicken with those salads. Wouldn't that be really great? Because the fried chicken maybe is not light, but the salads are.
You can be careful. You don't have to. It doesn't have to be greasy. You know, it shouldn't be greasy.
No,
crisp and light.
And where else are they going to get really great fried chicken? They're not going to get it in France. That's for sure. I mean, it's true.
That's true.
You know what, Luella? Go with the fried chicken.
Go with the fried chicken.
They're going to talk about it. They're going to be on that plane saying, "Did you believe how good that was?" And do the tomato aspic, do the green salad, and if you want to do something with a potato, do something with a potato.
And maybe make
the dessert something with fruit that's quite light.
We could do that. Well, I feel affirmed here, Lynn.
You should be, because you have such a great tradition, and they're going to revel in it.
All right. Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
You are welcome. You are welcome. And congratulations.
All right. Thanks so much.
You take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Who could turn down great homemade fried chicken? Oh. We've got Ellen calling from Pasadena. Ellen, what's up? What's on your mind?
I've got several cans of chestnut spread, crème de marron.
Oh, boy.
It's wonderful, but I've discovered I can't eat too much of it because my doctor will come after me. So I'm hoping to find other ways to use it, maybe in baked goods that I will give away.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, this is meant to fill anything from the center of a cupcake. You know, you can just put half the batter in and put in a spoonful of that beautiful puree of chestnut and then put in the rest of the batter. And surprise, when you bite into it, you have this beautiful chestnut filling. You can whip cream, then loosen this up with a little bit of cream, fold the two together, and you've got a frosting. Mm-hmm. You can also kind of whip it into a buttercream frosting, and it tastes really fabulous. One of the tricks people do is they lightly melt vanilla ice cream and they work it in and refreeze it. Another thing that it's used for is you do what's called a Mont Blanc, where you take whipped cream, you do a scoop of ice cream, but this you can't pass on to friends. This you could serve at a dinner party and you have a little whiff of it, but it's a scoop of ice cream and then a bit of whipped cream and then a couple of spoonfuls of the chestnut puree, and then it's another mound of whipped cream to look like a mountain. And Mont Blanc, you know, is this mountain that separates France from Italy. And everyone thinks it's filled with chestnut puree.
<Not delicious. laughs>
And the other thing is, I mean, you can add it to custards and you can add it, make a pound cake with it. You know, substitute. Yeah, yeah. Some people have substituted a bit of the butter in a pound cake with chestnut puree. Yeah. And you could do something like a black bottom pie, but do the chocolate on the bottom and then add a layer of the chestnut and then top that with whipped cream. Not a bad thing.
Now, and if you can substitute it for some of the butter, I wonder how that would work with cookies or brownies.
I think with brownies, you get a lot of leeway. With cookies, it's trickier. You know, you can get away with murder with brownies. With cookies, it's a little bit trickier. But think about pies, you know, tarts, that kind of thing. And chestnuts also love Italian meringue, which is a little tricky to make. You know, it's when you pour hot syrup into beating meringues, and it cooks the meringue. But that over the chestnut puree on top of a tart with a pre-cooked tart crust, that's pretty sexy stuff. Yeah, and they love chocolate, too. So that should give you some ideas to play with.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You are welcome, and what a lovely thing to have a lot of.
Yes.
You take care.
You too. Thank you.
Bye. 800-537-5252. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. You may remember back in 2010, I let a little jealousy slip on air. Michael Pollan had just had a tomato named after him. Now, being nuts about tomatoes, I mentioned wishing I could have my own tomato. Well, plant breeder Joseph Tykonovich heard my slip, and he responded. He was in the midst of developing a new tomato, and he offered to put my name on it. Well, in 2010, he sent samples. I picked a favorite. Well, it's been 2 years, and I think we need to catch up. Joseph, welcome.
Nice to be here.
So, Joseph, the Casper tomato, is it still viable?
It is still viable. I'm just getting ready to sow the seeds for the next generation to grow out this year.
So you sent in 22 samples for that tasting.
Right.
Number 12 was my pick, and I have my notes here. I really got carried away. I said, it tasted like a waltz, undulating sweet tart. It had a sense of white wine. I think I thought it was a dry Riesling, if it'd be really specific. Has that taste altered at all over the past 2 years?
Well, I've tried my best to keep that from altering. So each generation, what I'm doing now is kind of reducing the variability. So every time I plant the seeds, I get a diversity of different flavors, and that gets less each generation until something that's stable. So every year when I plant it, I taste through them to try to, you know, find the individual that best mimics that flavor that you really liked in the first. So hopefully the final product will be pretty similar to what you picked out originally.
One of the things that really surprised me, you sent 22 tomatoes. Mm-hmm. Each one of them tasted quite different.
Right.
But you said they were all a cross between the same tomatoes.
Yeah, the same two tomatoes.
Yeah.
So the two parents, one is Matt's Wild Cherry, which is a really sweet, tiny cherry tomato. And the other parent was a variety called Black Creme, which is a wonderful heirloom.
Right, very rich and wine-like
right.
in flavor. Yeah.
So when you have such different flavors coming through the two parents, when you cross them, you're shuffling up their genes and getting all the different combinations of those flavors. So you see a huge range of different combinations of sweet and tart and rich and all everything.
So when you start actually creating these tomatoes, is this a case of taking pollen from one tomato flower because that plant the last time tasted like it had a lot of sweetness to it, and you take that pollen from there and you put that pollen into the flower of a tomato that was quite tart, so you get more sweet tart balance? Is it that basic?
That's exactly it. It's really that simple. You pick two parents that have traits you like and you make them have babies together.
So when you move that pollen from one tomato flower to that other tomato flower, that's going to be the plant that's going to give you the hybrid or the combination.
Right. So the fruit that will develop from that flower, those seeds in it are the hybrids that will then plant out. And those seeds will then grow out. And then in the second generation, you'll see those genes recombine in new combinations that give you all the diversity that you got to taste.
And so you just keep doing that until you narrow it down to what you want.
Yeah, exactly. And then in my case, because it's so much fun seeing the diversity, once I've narrowed it down to what I want, I then cross it with something else to take it up again.
So any gardener can do this, right?
Yeah, it really is. It's really that simple. And it's, you know, we think about the heirloom tomato varieties. Those are all bred by home gardeners, basically, and, you know, small farmers. It's only pretty recently that that it's become big business to breed plants. But the basics are really pretty straightforward and really fun.
So armed with some tweezers and some imagination, you can just go out there and make your own tomatoes or
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I do it with just about everything in my garden. This year I'll be growing a pepper population, which will be fun because it's a cross between a sweet pepper and a habanero. So it's going to be,
it's going to be
total chaos.
So do you have any idea when the LRK tomato may really be the LRK tomato and, you know, make her debut?
I'm hoping if the weather and everything cooperates by the end of this year, I should have it finished up so that next spring the finished variety will be ready to share with you and anyone else who wants it.
Well, you should know, I am deeply flattered that you wanted to name a tomato after me, and I look forward to next year, and thank you, and have a great growing season.
All righty, thank you.
Joseph Tykonovich is a plant breeder in Michigan. His forthcoming book is Creating New Heirlooms, A Gardener's Guide to Breeding Plants. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, and until next time, let me leave you with this from William Cuppy, who said, "Just when you're beginning to think pretty well of people, you run across somebody who puts sugar on sliced tomatoes." This Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Head to our website, splendidtable.org, to browse our recipes. Visit our online store, get registered for our weekly newsletters, and our brand new podcast, The Key Three, conversations with star cooks about the three dishes they think every good cook should know. Check it all out, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Gettin. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Chris Peters. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. You have a good one. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.